You may proceed.
May it please the court. When detectives came to interview Kevin Hicks in 2008, after a cold hit on his cousin from a crime committed in 1992, he agreed to talk to them, but he wanted an agreement from them. He did not want to extend his out date on the term of imprisonment he was already serving.
The detectives, so couldn't you have the term of the new crimes concurred in some part, but extend beyond the point at which it's concurrent?
It can only start running at the date you're sentenced. So, yes, he'd already been serving the sentence he was already serving. He'd actually been serving it since the day after this crime was committed in 1992. These offenses were one day apart. So he'd been in prison, essentially, since this other offense in 92. So there's no doubt, there's no question that it can't be concurrent in that sense. It can't be retroactively concurrent. But Mr. Hicks was very clear in his discussions with the detectives that, whereas he may have been unrealistic in that
is what governs what the actual agreement was. Because in this case, we do have a written plea agreement.
I've raised it both ways, Your Honor, and I think, interestingly, it's, if you look at this under a traditional involuntary confession, Fourth Amendment due process analysis, you look at what Mr. Hicks thought. You look at subjectively what his expectation from the agreement was. But I think...
Is that to be a meeting of the minds?
I think under this court's Hoops case, you can look at it under traditional contract analysis. And I think that is actually the better way of looking at this. I looked at some of the other cases, and we've cited, for example, that Justin Brown case from the Southern District. For the more traditional due process analysis, where you look at whether promises made to him coerced him, whether the proffer of leniency coerced his confession. And interestingly, when you read those cases, they sound like contract cases until you get up to that point. And then in Brown, he reneged on the deal. Mr. Brown said, the prosecutor said, you can plead guilty to this if you're actually innocent of it and you make this confession. And it turns out that Mr. Brown was involved in that offense, so he couldn't take the plea agreement. So in that case, the court analyzes it up to the point where as a contract case, it really feels like that. And then they say
was he represented in negotiating his contract?
I don't recall that, Your Honor. Mr. Hicks? Hicks was not.
Hicks was not represented.
Hicks was not represented.
He was offered his...
He was offered counsel. He was offered counsel, and his expressed belief was that he would have to stop talking to the police officers if he got an attorney. What I was saying about the Brown case, at that point they say if he had not reneged on the deal, then he was no longer coerced. If the state had, if both parties had lived up to their end of it, then there would have been coercion. And it seems to me that that's apples and oranges. The contract analysis makes more sense, and that's what this court applied in the Hoops case. And if that's the analysis that works better, then we look at what a reasonable person would have thought this contract meant, what this agreement would have meant.
Was there any representation like you see all the time, and maybe it's fiction, of, we may go easy on you, but if you get an attorney, all bets are off.
They did not say that to him, Your Honor. And this court and all the courts of appeals have distinguished between those sorts of general promises of leniency. It'll go better for you if you talk. I'll tell the prosecutor that you've cooperated. Those have not been found to be the sort of coercion that has been an enforceable promise, as opposed to something like this where you have a written agreement. And the agreement is very clear. It says, now the state and I have quibbled about some of the language means, but it says they agree that he will be sentenced to a term of imprisonment for these crimes to be served concurrently with his current prison sentences. And let me be clear, Mr. Hicks lived up to his end of this bargain. This is not the Justin Brown situation. This is not the Clement situation where the defendant couldn't basically live up to his end, you know, where he refused to then take the polygraph test, where he refused
What is there that the state didn't live up to?
The state did not give him concurrent time because they couldn't under the statute.
Well, answer this question. The trial court made a finding that there was no deception or false promise made by either side. Okay, what false promise do you claim was made?
The state promised him sentences that would run concurrently with his current sentence, and by operation of law, the sex offenses that were charged had to run consecutively to the non-sex offenses.
But those were with the ones that he hadn't talked about yet. The agreement was that they would run concurrent with his current ones, which
No, this did. Is, these are all arising out of the same incident, that there was robberies and rapes and sodomies, all arising from the same incident. And this was what he was confessing to and
right, but
snitching on the
wasn't
other five
that,
parties.
The agreement wasn't that the new charges would run concurrent with each other.
Yes, but yes. That they would run concurrently with his what he was already serving. The language doesn't specify. But, Your Honor, if we're applying contract analysis, You have to look to see what a reasonable person
would
have thought that.
What consideration does the state get? If you're applying contract analysis, what consideration does the state get if they don't get any extra time?
He confessed and told five other people.
Yeah, he told about five other people. They wanted him to implicate others. And he
absolutely. This is
so
the sort of agreement the state makes all the time.
Right. But you're saying...
Maybe I'm confused in the facts, but as I understand the agreement, or at least the part that the agreement was that the state would recommend that any new sentence received would run concurrent with the one on which he was currently receiving.
And the state believes that they have lived up to their part of the bargain because the total sentence package is running concurrently to his prior sentence, which is why it is important to see not only what Mr. Hicks would have thought that agreement meant, but what a reasonable person would have thought that agreement meant.
Doesn't it really go to whether or not, though, in regard to your argument about whether or not it was voluntary, why doesn't it depend on whether or not anybody was deceived or made a false promise as it relates to his voluntariness? Because when he's making these statements,
yes.
I mean, the state didn't know what he was going to say.
Right.
They didn't know what the new charges were going to be.
That's correct. And the state may have made a bad bargain in itself as well. The prosecutor certainly may have made a bad bargain if the prosecutor... Now, fortunately, we have all of those discussions between Mr. Hicks and the detectives, and some of those are in the appendix. And he says, you know, this case. I'm not talking about any murders or anything. It's just this case. And he says that to the detectives. So that's something that the parties were aware of at the
time.
I'm
not sure you've clarified for the court why what happened didn't meet the bargain. And I think from your brief, my understanding of the argument is that all the charges against him based on this incident would run concurrent to the prior charges. That means once he got convicted, they'd all start running. And because under statute, the sex offenses had to run separately, had to start after the robbery charges, they didn't all run concurrent, which was his agreement, because they ran seriatim instead of all starting at the same time to run with the remainder of his current sentence.
That's correct. And if it is ambiguous that concurrent doesn't mean concurrent, it only means concurrent with the prior things, and we can run some of these. My answer to that is twofold. One, if it is ambiguous, the prosecutor drafted this agreement, and any ambiguity inures to the benefit of the defendant in that regard. Secondly, it's clear from the sentencing hearing and from the discussions between the trial court and the prosecutor and the defense counsel at trial that they all thought that this meant we have to run these concurrently because they tried to do it as much as they could.
But can the prosecutor agree to something that's illegal?
They tried to run everything concurrent that they could. They ran all of the sex counts concurrently within each other. They ran the two robberies concurrently within each other and ran those consecutive. And they discussed that. They discussed that at the trial. Well, we're running as much concurrent as we can, but we can't run these. They didn't say, we can give him nine consecutive life sentences, which they could have.
Under their interpretation, Judge Teitelman's question goes to, but of course the state, they can't because the prosecutor promised something that in fact legally was impossible. Is it your argument that nonetheless they have to do something that's not allowed under the statute, or what is the remedy for this? Is it that there's no agreement, or is it what?
The remedy is twofold. I think that this case can be remanded so that the confession can be suppressed, and then the prosecutor can retry all of these charges without the confession. Or secondly, the prosecutor can choose to elect between the sex and the non-sex offenses so that everything can run concurrently. Since the state has conceded that one of these robberies goes away, and there's one robbery and six sex offenses, I would assume that the state would elect to keep the 30-year sentence on the sex offenses and not the 15 that's consecutive on now, the one remaining robbery.
What obligation? Now, it's one thing for a defendant to say, I don't need an attorney, I will confess the crime, the facts of the crime, and that's that. However, when you're talking about a contract, what obligation is there on one side, which is fully represented by the state and attorneys, to still go into negotiation without saying, I can't negotiate with you for a contract? I'm not talking about confession, but a contract unless you have an attorney.
It certainly means, Judge, that, as I pointed out, that any ambiguity should be to our benefit. That because Mr. Hicks was unrepresented and may have made a bad bargain, as I think the prosecutor may have made a bad bargain, also not knowing what all of the charges that could have arisen from this would have been. But if this language is ambiguous, or if a reasonable person would have not read it the way the prosecutor thought he was offering, then Mr. Hicks should have benefited.
Generally speaking, you can't contract for an illegal act. I mean, you can't contract for something that's unlawful.
If Mr. Hicks had been represented by an attorney who made this sort of agreement, I'd be here arguing he was ineffective.
The what's interesting is the agreement isn't that his term of his imprisonment would run concurrently for his own confession. The agreement's only limited. Isn't the agreement only limited to his information about other individuals? So if in fact the agreement is not valid, why is the remedy that his confession is not admissible?
I think that's the remedy I actually asked for in the Court of Appeals, Your Honor.
I know, but what I'm saying is the agreement doesn't have anything to do with his own confession. It has to do with whether or not he will provide information against other people. So if the agreement wasn't made to cover the confession, why is the remedy to keep his confession out?
The statement does provide that information. I think that was what was contemplated, was that he'd go ahead and tell the detectives everything about
it. It was his confession that implicated the others.
It was.
I
don't think that's been considered to be an issue.
You're saying you can't separate out his implication of other persons from his own confession.
No, I don't think so. There were hours and hours of his statements mm-hmm. after this, spilling everything.
Was the trial court's finding that there was no deception or false promise made by either side supported by the evidence?
That there was no deception or false promise?
Right. The trial court made a finding that there was no deception or false promise made by either side.
I certainly argued that this is deception under traditional 14th Amendment analysis, Your Honor. That's our point one. I'm not conceding that. No, I think that there, under that analysis, this rises to the level of deception and coercion that induced his confession. But I think that analysis, and I realize I'm talking out of both sides of my mouth, is somewhat illogical, and the contract analysis makes more sense.
Because it looked like, I mean, this is a situation where they went back and said, no, the prosecutor says that's the deal, here it is, it's writing, this is as good as it gets, and all this is on video, and then the guy goes ahead and makes his statement.
He made right. he probably should have had a lawyer.
Well, did they try to give him one every
they
time,
did.
Right? So sometimes it's awful hard to help somebody who won't help themselves.
That's true, Your Honor.
You have time for rebuttal.
Thank you.
Now, isn't there a principle that the police can deceive you and lie to you and do whatever they want to get a confession? They can say, the other person is going to confess.
Be careful how you answer.
I wouldn't say that they can do whatever they want. I mean, there are...
They're allowed to deceive and I wouldn't use the word lie then. Deceive and use other devices to get a confession, whether or not they're true or false?
Within certain limits. The police are able to, I think, misrepresent some facts in order to get a confession, but I don't really think that's what happened here. The prosecutor was involved in the case, made an agreement with the defendant, and the state's position here is that the state fulfilled its end of the bargain. The dissent in the Western District framed the case really as asking whether the state is required to honor its commitments, and the answer to that question, of course, is yes. But in this,
but the sex offenses didn't run concurrent with the prior sentences. They ran seriatim. They ran after the, was it, which one was first, robbery or the sex offenses? Which one was the ordered to serve first?
The robbery was first.
I believe the robbery was first.
So, and then the sex offenses started, he started serving them after the robbery, right? So they did, well, they were not run concurrent with his prior sentences. The robbery was.
No.
It started, but the sex offenses were not, because they didn't start them with his prior sentences.
Well, there is a difference, Your Honor, between the word sentences and term of imprisonment. And the agreement here uses the phrase term of imprisonment. I think that appellant has, changed a little bit the interpretation of the argument that she's presenting. In the brief, appellant argued that the reason the state didn't honor its commitment in this case was that instead of getting one term of imprisonment, the defendant received two. But there is no legal basis for that argument. Very commonly, Missouri courts, I cited a few cases in my brief, Judge Ahuja, in his majority opinion, found a half dozen more, in which the phrase term of imprisonment is used by Missouri courts to mean a set of sentences run consecutive to one another. That's what happened in this case.
And you think that's what he bargained for and thought he was getting here, or do you think it's ambiguous that what he was saying is, I'll confess if the sentences I get for these crimes start running concurrently with the sentences I'm already serving?
I do not believe that the latter is what he bargained for. He bargained for what was written on this piece of paper. And it
and
is true.
And isn't it ambiguous as to whether it means that or that you can serve him seriatim out 150 years and that's why he confessed and bargained? Is that a reasonable interpretation? Certainly, I mean, I understand that's the state's interpretation. They could have run all nine consecutive to each other, but isn't it reasonable to read it the other way and, in fact, logical that he would not have confessed had he thought you could put nine sentences out one after the other?
Well, I mean, I think there are a lot of facts that answer
and
that question.
And I'm not saying yours is unreasonable, but the point is it's ambiguous, and one can read that confession to think they're going to be concurrent with them. They're all going to be concurrent. You have an alternative argument, but on who does the ambiguity fall?
Right. Well, let me try to answer that question in a couple of ways. First, the question of ambiguity. I do not believe that this agreement is ambiguous. There is a difference between ambiguity and silence as to a particular term, or not adding a particular detail about a particular term. Here, for example, the phrase that seems to be most at issue is term of imprisonment. That is not ambiguous. It is not ambiguous as to what term of imprisonment means. The detail about does that mean multiple sentences run consecutively, concurrently, is it one sentence? That's not included in this agreement. The agreement is silent as to that point, although it is not difficult to read the written agreement and realize there will be multiple sentences within that term of imprisonment, because it says term of imprisonment for his involvement.
Now, was there a meeting of the minds? I mean, he thought he was going to get, that's why he's doing it, he's going to get concurrent sentences, not get more time. Did the prosecutor think the same thing or not?
Actually, Your Honor, it is clear from the record that he was not told he was not going to get more time.
They could run longer, but they would run concurrently.
There is nothing in the record to support that he believed that. No one, aside from defense attorneys, have said that Mr. Hicks misunderstood this agreement. He did not testify at the suppression hearing.
Well, I didn't say he misunderstood it. I think he understood it. I mean, both of you disagree as to what it means.
But isn't that ambiguity? Whether or not the record supports the finding that it was voluntarily made.
Yeah, that's certainly the issue for the constitutional question, which is what was raised to the Western District and raised to the trial court. And I think there is ample evidence that it was voluntarily made. And Judge Stith and I think Judge Teitelman, to address another point that you've raised, would it be reasonable to think that Mr. Hicks would not have agreed to confess or made these statements but for the state's interpretation of the agreement? And I think it's not reasonable to reach that conclusion. The record is replete with evidence that Mr. Hicks wanted to provide this statement.
But he wouldn't do it unless you could reach the prosecutor and get the deal. So I think it's pretty clear that it was his remorse that led him to speak if he could get a deal.
If he could get a deal. If he could get a deal, not necessarily the deal that defense counsel now says he thinks he was getting.
The record of the conversation following the review of this written document supports that he understood that it may not accomplish what he wanted, and then he went ahead and still went forward with the deal.
Exactly, Your Honor. I think he understood, and you know, it makes sense. There's he goes on for pages in these transcripts about how the crime that he committed, admittedly, I mean, 15, 20 years earlier, had eaten at him. He took 12-step programs. He took victim empathy classes. He wanted to take responsibility. He says specifically, and this is in Exhibit 13 on page 737, he realizes, you might have nothing on me. I realize that I could get a lawyer. I could say, get lost. I mean, he uses more colorful language, but I want a lawyer. But I'm not going to say that because that's not taking responsibility.
Yeah, but what the prosecutor simply said, I can't tell you what your out date's going to be because I don't know what you're going to confess to, which is right. You don't know how long the term of imprisonment's going to be. The prosecutor didn't say, I can't tell you if it's going to be, if these sentences will be concurrent or consecutive to each other. So that wasn't the thing he said, okay, I'll still confess. He said, I understand you're not going to tell me my maximum sentence, in other words. And he said, I'll still confess, and he made that choice. But that's very different than suggesting he understood that he didn't know if they'd all run concurrent with the existing sentences, which is the purpose of his bargain, was to make him run that way.
Well, I disagree that was the purpose of his bargain. He did not know. It is true that he did not know whether the sentences that he got for the the offenses that he's newly providing information for, he did not know whether they would run concurrently or consecutively. And he did not know that because that was not part of the agreement.
Please remind me, how much was he currently serving? What was his prior sentence? How many years?
Well, his prior sentence, I think, was for 25 years. The date that he was set to be released was in 2018.
Okay.
And you might have to do the math.
And when did he when did he confess?
This was in 2008, so he had another 10 years on the sentence.
Okay, so he had 10 years left, and this new sentence came up to a total of 45 years.
Correct.
And
the new term of imprisonment.
Excuse me. Right. And that's because the 7-30-year sentences came after the 215.
Correct.
But his argument is those 7-30 years and those 215 sentences should have been concurrent within themselves.
That is his argument, yes. And that he argues that is what, in fact, he says, Ms. Flipman said, the agreement is very clear. I think it's very clear, and we both think it's very clear that it means two different things.
15 years difference. He thinks he should have got down 15 years earlier.
Correct.
When you keep saying this person never testified to the version of the agreement that his counsel are suggesting.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So when you say he, you really mean his attorneys.
That is exactly what I mean.
But if he wanted to, he could have taken the stand at the suppression hearing and given any version of facts that he wanted to about what he thought he believed the agreement was.
That's right.
But he did not do so.
He did not. And there is nothing in the record to suggest that he had the understanding of the agreement that his attorneys have advanced.
But some consideration, we're talking about Kant, some consideration could be he wants to confess to clear his mind, his conscience, that's a benefit to him for why he's going to confess.
Absolutely. And in fact, that's
whether or not the concurrent or consecutive, that is a benefit to him.
It is a benefit.
I could say that he's clearing his conscience and it's all clear and it's whatever he did.
That's right, and I don't think that we should be dismissive of that. He says very explicitly throughout the record that was important to him, that he take responsibility. And I'm not trying to say that the agreement that he reached was immaterial. I mean, because he did plainly want a deal, but it does not follow that he plainly wanted the deal or expected that he was getting the deal that his attorneys now claim he thought he was getting. Because the text of the agreement, and as I think Judge Ahuja went through this very thoroughly in his opinion, relates the term of imprisonment that he'd be getting for these newly described offenses would run concurrently with Kevin Hicks's current prison sentences. He was already in prison. There's no ambiguity. There's no misunderstanding about what that means. The new sentences in relation to the sentences he's already serving. That's what he bargained for. It was not a bad deal. I think Judge Russell, as you were pointing out, he had 10, by the time of his trial, 9 years left on the old sentences. This deal, this arrangement, saved him 9 years of his life. That's not nothing. That's not a bad deal, especially when you're already motivated to cooperate, as he claimed that he was, as he explained he was, and as the trial court found.
How old is he now? You said 9 years of his life out. How old is he now?
I don't know the answer to that. I'm not sure how old he is. But 9 years is important no matter how old you are, right?
Well, if it's 20 years and he's 25, that might be something.
Oh, he's not 100. I think that he was around 20 in 1992. So, I mean, 20 years have passed. I think he's around 40 now, but I'm not certain of that. And Ms. Loeb may be able to fill you in on that detail.
Thank you.
Unless there are any questions, any further questions, Your Honor, I'd ask that the state or the
much.
Court affirm. Thank you.
You may proceed. Rebuttal.
I don't think this case turns on the definition of term of imprisonment. Mr. Farnsworth and I spent a lot of time, we talked about this a lot in the Western District, talking about there's cases that say use the word terms, sentences. It's all over the board and doesn't seem to have a legal definition. I think what is important is what a reasonable person reading this agreement would have thought it meant. And that's, and I don't think any reasonable person would have known a term of imprisonment to be served concurrently didn't mean that. That meant that my sex offenses won't start until I have finished serving the term that is completed. And actually, with his CR date, it would have been 2015 that he would have gotten out on the earlier offense. So he doesn't start those sex offenses until that out date is passed. And I also want to address the remorse issue a little bit, because he does say over and over that he's sorry, he's been through 12-step, he's confessing for that reason. He also, when the detective showed up on a Friday to talk to him, said, don't come back, I'm not talking to you till I get an agreement from the prosecutor. And they couldn't even get that from till the Monday, and they came back to him on a Monday. So that's what you've got away in terms of how much this was induced by his remorse and how much it was induced by him wanting a deal. You know, he it's possible that he wouldn't have been, they couldn't have proved this against him without this confession. The cold hit was on his cousin. When you've got six people who are going to be approached and asked for a statement, you want to be the first one of the six to make that statement. I think that it is certainly a reasonable interpretation that's his inducement as well, that he is being induced by, I can get the best deal from the state for being the first one out of the box to confess to this and to snitch on the other five people.
There's a lot of crimes are solved because the defendant either talks to someone in the prison, talks to someone that they come in contact with. If they never talk to people about their crime.
He apparently didn't talk for 16 years, Judge.
What's the significance, in response to Judge Fisher's questions, what's the significance that he has never, there's no evidence in the record as to what he believes the agreement was?
There's no evidence.
If you argue under contract analysis that the agreement is ambiguous, then intent becomes significant, and there's no evidence as to what his intent was.
There's no evidence from the suppression hearing, and that's absolutely true. The evidence I would urge this court to look at is all of his statements made during the negotiations with the detectives, that he didn't want any more time, that he didn't want his out date extended. He said, I don't want this open to interpretation or debate. I want this to mean what it says it means. I think it's pretty clear what he thought it meant.
Is it his subjective view at that time, or is it a reasonable person test? Or
Under traditional 14th Amendment analysis, it is his subjective view because it is voluntariness.
Right.
And that's a subjective
and
test.
Under contract,
it is a reasonable person. So.
But when we're looking at the issue of whether or not his confession is suppressed, I mean, is there any legitimate legal way to analyze it other than the voluntariness of the statement?
And Hoops, then, wh- and then whether does, or not, Your Honor. And Hoops cites Santabello and says this is no different than a plea agreement, that an agreement to confess is no different than a plea agreement. Mm-hmm. And that's what the Hoops case was based on.
And even in that situation, though, that the issue was whether or not, I mean, there was some evidence in that case as to whether or not the statement.
Yes.
Right. I mean, there's still evidence that the trial court has to evaluate to determine whether or not the statement was made voluntarily or not.
That's the way the analysis always
it's
starts.
All,
and
even
the traditional voluntariness
it's all thrown
cases.
In, it's all thrown in there.
It is. Even the traditional voluntariness cases say within a reasonable limit what he believed. Mm-hmm. So there's a reasonableness component
to
that,
too. Had he had he chosen to testify at the motion to suppress hearing, would those statements have later been able to be used against him?
No, not at the trial, not in the case in chief.
Right. So there was There was no harm in him testifying as to what he believed the agreement was at the motion to suppress hearing.
We would certainly have a better record, Your Honor.
Thank you very much. Case will be taken under submission.